The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2013 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of five recordings from the retreat called Upadana, the Buddha's Teaching on Attachment, taught by Gloria Terania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat teacher, Gloria Terania Ambrosia, is a student of the Western Forest Sangha and a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She serves as a core faculty member at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies and has been a Dharma teacher since 1990. More information on Terania can be found at www.bcbsdharma.org.
So I want to look tonight at another kind of attachment that is this one really gets my attention, especially when I first, not when I first came upon it, but when I first started to really contemplate what the Buddha was saying in this one. And it's a key player in the process of waking up. Maybe you've heard about the 10 fetters and the various stages of awakening, and these fetters get uprooted during the course or the process of practice, and some are uprooted at certain stages. Well, the first stage of awakening really gets our attention, or should anyway, because it's presumably what we're all working on. We're trying to at least realize this level of awakening in this lifetime. And the three of the fetters are uprooted at this stage. One is overcoming skeptical doubt, where you get to a place where you're experiencing so much the fruits of practice that the questioning ceases. You know, you sort of get to this place where you know you're on the right path. You know how to practice, and all that's left is just to keep at it. So that, skeptical doubt is framed in this language of, overcoming doubt in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. You know, we really get it. Overcoming self-view is one of them. I'll talk a little bit about that before the weekend is out. And this other one, is overcoming attachment. This is one of the forms of attachment to rites, rituals, precepts, and practices. The Pali word for I love to say, but it's a mouthful. It's called Sila Bhatta Paramasa. And you may hear it sometimes through your travels through Buddhism. And it's a clinging to, rites, to, structures, to techniques, to anything of a systematic nature. It's like, one gets tied up with the structure and doesn't contemplate adequately what the structure is designed to take you to. You get obsessed with perfecting a technique and don't adequately reflect on what that technique is trying to get you to. And it can even play out in a form of clinging to principles where, you know, you dig your heels in around a right thing, the way that things should be, instead of acknowledging or recognizing that any kind of notion like that is about the experience underneath it. It's not about the principle. You get locked into that things at that level. So it's similar to attachment to sense objects in one way, and that is that you feel happy, or you feel confident, you feel safe, you feel secure when you think you're doing it right, being right, and following aligned with some kind of system or technique. We've all done this, and we all do it a lot. And maybe if you're not connecting just yet with what I'm saying, I believe that you will, because it's very obvious once you begin to start contemplating it, how much we do it, and much more obvious even when you start to look at your behaviors and see how it is that we're doing it. So it's kind of like if you can feel this, it's like a clinging that gets locked into the head and doesn't take things down to the heart level, doesn't take things down to the intuitive or the experiential level. It's all very heady. It should be this. It should be that. This is the right way. This is the thing to do. This is the technique. This is the teacher. Make sure you get with this teacher. Do this, do this, do this. It's all that kind of level. And it's not entirely without value, but it's just that we're locked into it as being the ultimate, the way that things are. And it plays out very heavily both in our daily lives. I like to look at it first at the mundane level, just how we're doing this in our daily lives, because this can be the beginning of breaking up these crystallized patterns, you know. But it has a very technical meaning as well, which has to do with how we're holding the practices of Buddhism. Our Buddhist practices can definitely be held in this way, and I've sort of been hinting at it through the weekend so far. As long as we're locked into it at that level, then those practices aren't going to serve us in the way that they have the potential to serve us. So this is why I think it's so important to really understand what he's getting at here. But first, let's just look at it in our daily lives, in this mundane way. And this has to do with sort of looking at our activity, the ways that we spend our time, our activities in our daily lives, and the way we do things, the way that we live our lives. And what happens is that too easily, we sort of like glaze over. And certain routines, certain things that we do on a regular basis, because probably, and partly I think it's just because they're neutral feeling. they don't have a lot of charge in them. They aren't sexy. They aren't interesting. I mean, you don't derive a huge identity around brushing your teeth in the morning. You know, you don't get a big all puffed up feeling. You know, look at me. I'm a toothbrusher. You know, it doesn't have that kind of hit to it, you know. And so it's just, we just kind of glaze over around these kinds of things. And, we get, locked into repetitive behaviors and essentially, vacate the premises. It's like, hello, you know, you're not there anymore. It's just, living sort of, drone-like, existence within these kinds of activities. And one of the ways they become apparent, I think, at least for me, they have is, say, traveling. Like, I travel a lot. And so, it's just something as basic as getting up on the left side of the bed, which I do at home. But then when I travel, I'm in all kinds of beds, you know, and the toilet paper is in different places, you know, and the shower knobs are in different places. And, you know, you can really see how disorienting it can be. But not because it's disorienting intrinsically. It's because I'm locked into something else. You know, I get locked into an old way. I mean, some of this is, you don't want to split hairs about this, is normal. But you want to see how you can become aware of it. You know, and this kind of thing. And sometimes, some people experience it, when they come on retreat because, you can get a lot of resistance to being into, just walking and sitting and walking and sitting, you know. Well, no, I mean, this is the time of day I go for my walk, or this is when I do this, or this is when I do that, you know, or the food. Well, I don't eat that kind of stuff. I want this stuff, you know. Can you feel it? You just sort of, you start to become aware of how, we're very much locked in, we give ourselves over to routine. And I think this is very much why the Buddha, recommended for the monastic community, he encouraged them to go wandering. You know, at least in the early teachings and the early Buddhist practices, they would go on what's called tudong, and they would set out with just their robes and their bowl and maybe a net to protect them from mosquitoes and a toothpick. You know, basically that's what they would, and then wander. And the idea would be to not stay in the same place more than one night, you know, to be in completely different environments and go to completely different villages for the meal, you know, practice in completely different places. And this was strongly encouraged in the monastic communities in Buddhism. And I'm sure that it's a lot of it has to do with getting at this. You know, don't it's all just happening now. You know, it's all just here and now. And what are you going to do to try to collapse your capacity to pay attention here. You know, you're breaking out of routines that move you out of that sense. It can be very, very helpful. So one gal I met a number of years ago, it was great. She was kind of working with this in her own practice, and she began to become aware, well, it was of something that was a real issue in her family, with her partner and her daughter and her, which is that when she cooks, when she's in the kitchen, it all has to be done her way. It's just that there was no bending. You know, you have to use these knives, you use these serving bowls, you cut the carrots this way, we cook things this way, all of this. And it was a source of great contention, in the family. But everybody would just argue about it and put up with it, you know, through many years. But she started to see it through the eyes of this particular teaching and realize how locked in she was to, certain behaviors. That, you know, for myself, I've done the same thing at Buddhist monasteries where you're in the kitchen. You better let go, you know, because there's all kinds of people with all kinds of ideas about how things should be done, you know. And the kitchen is where all the knives are, you know. you really got to let go. And so she was just really beginning to see this. And so she said, well, what can I do? I got to come up with some way to break it. And because she couldn't, you know, she was just very, very deliberate about her way. So they decided, she got her family together, and they decided to buy her a tiara. And that the tiara would live in the kitchen on top of the microwave oven. And whenever this was happening, whoever noticed it first could grab the tiara and put it on her head. And then at that point, they had options. She's the queen of the kitchen. Are we going to let her be queen of the kitchen? Because that's fine. Somebody's got to be the boss, you know. Or are we just going to have a laugh and let the tiara be the acknowledgement that, oh, you're in it again. You know, you're doing it. And it was great. She said on a really good day, they all would just have a good laugh. And she could let it go or not, but it didn't matter anymore. It just kind of cut through because one had identified that as an attachment to a system, attachment to a procedure. And then once the attachment has been identified, you know, you can do it or not. it's a whole different ballgame at that point. So it can be very good just to notice these kinds of routines and how we're relating to them and just try to loosen up around this kind of thing in our lives. I'm sure if we went around the room, you all have stories about this very kind of thing. You all know exactly what I'm talking about. But just to be clear in this, I don't think the Buddha in any way is saying not to have routines and not to have, structures in our lives. And in many ways, they're unavoidable. And, certainly in our work environments, you know, you wouldn't have a job very long if you said, well, I don't think I want to come in at 9 o'clock. You know, that's not my routine. You have to fit into the structures and the systems that, we are involved in. But, and with a family, especially with children, when kids are small, you know, there's a security in having certain routines. And it's a way of socializing them to get used to things, to get used to cooperating with other people and getting things done. And a lot of these routines in the household have to do with getting the job done. You know, it's the same way in the monasteries. Lots of routines, lots of structures. But the idea here is that it can be very rich to see how attached we can become within that. And as I said, become drone-like. So that we're not actually alive and alert and awake within the simple activities of our lives. And, you know, as I said yesterday, we can live our whole lives in those modes. You can live your whole life in driven, compulsive, obsessive modes, which would be okay, as I said, if it felt good, but it doesn't, you know. So again, we're not saying don't have routines, but I think what the Buddha is pointing to is just to see ourselves do that and try to awaken and feel present within what it is that we're doing. And I was telling a group today too, I started to, a number of years ago, to make a practice out of, trying to, be present and fully awake right away, first thing in the morning. And it really came out of, I didn't give them the backstory, but it came out of a noticing in my own life how I would, it's like I'd get up in the morning and, you know, pee and start to brush my teeth. And while I'm brushing my teeth, I'm walking around the house and opening up the blinds and tidying up, picking this thing up and still brushing, you know, and going and getting the coffee started while I'm still brushing my teeth and putting the towel back on the rack in the bathroom and I'm still brushing my teeth. And it was like, you know, what are you doing? It's just like this is so unimportant and uninteresting that it's like background music. It's like, you know, for while I'm doing everything else, or everything is so unimportant that I just got to do it all at once and get it all over with, that kind of thing. And when I saw myself doing it, it was kind of startling, to see how I was sort of multitasking into oblivion, you know. And I don't think that it's not the case that you can't multitask and be present to it. I think you can. You know, you have to look and see. But I wasn't present to any of this. It was just all, in this, glazed over mode. So just beginning to see the effect of that, you know. And what I did was then start a practice immediately. And I've been doing it for about 15 years now, where I don't get up out of bed. If there's a hint of these kinds of driven things, being the momentum behind that action. You know, that what I do is I literally wait. It doesn't take long. It's not like you're going to lay in bed all morning. You're going to have to get up and pee, you know? So it's not like you're going to lay there all day, but, you know, you just kind of go, okay, now wait a minute. If it starts to, you know, then ramp it down and find that still small voice, find that presence of mind, and be darn well sure that you're there in that, and watch the getting up happen. You know, you lose this sense of me as the one who's driving my day. And begin to really wake up to the realization that this system really is running itself. We're kind of along for the ride, you know. But also, more importantly, I think you break out of these, this kind of glazed, relationship with life, glazed over relationship. So just look at that. I mean, that's up to you. I found this part of it very, very helpful. Just to look at how, we're attached to systems and rituals and routines in our daily life, and do some things to break it up. You know, like maybe one of the routines is to immediately make a pot of coffee every morning. And maybe you need that. I don't know, but I'll bet. I mean, I began to wake up to the fact that I didn't. In fact, one time when I started to make the coffee, and I was in this more quiet place, I actually had kind of a gag response. And, you know, I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the truth was that my stomach was very acid, you know. It didn't want any coffee. Don't send any coffee down, you know. I don't want it. And so just to consider the possibility that there are other ways to start the day. It sounds simple and very, very basic, but I think it is more significant than we might realize. So I just encourage you to try this out, try some of these things out. So now I want to look at the Buddhist practices and how we can cling to these, our spiritual practices. And what I'm talking about here is dana, sila, and bhavana, the generosity, ethical conduct, and the meditation practice. And in essence, what he's saying here is that this kind of clinging has to do with kind of thinking that our freedom can be found in getting good at doing these practices. You know, just getting good at or doing them, or doing them out of a sense of obligation, or out of a sense of righteousness. You know, the sense that you should meditate, you should keep the precept, you should offer dana. This kind of stuff. This is subtle, I realize, but he's pointing to a way that we're holding it in our minds. Because what happens if we're holding it in that way is we never really get to the experience that these practices are trying to get us to. You know, we're holding it up here. You're holding it out of it's a kind of an attaching to an idea about the practice rather than feeling it directly in our moment-to-moment experience. So just looking at each of these for a little bit, when we hold dana in that way, dana is the practice of generosity. And it's kind of unfortunate that in the West this has gotten picked up mostly as dana is about offering to teachers or offering to retreat centers and things like that. And it gives the false sense of what the Buddha is trying to get at here. You know, dana is so much more than that. What happens is we get locked into an idea about giving or the task of giving or the gift itself. And we can get totally preoccupied with thinking about what we need to do in order to be generous. You know, what does that look like? What do I have to do in order to become, be seen as generous? And, never actually enter the actual feeling of generosity as a state of heart, state of mind. What is it like? What does it feel like? And we can forget that's what it's all about. That's what we're trying to cultivate. And, generosity is a key player in this process of waking up because it's the primary antidote to the grasping. You know, because the grasping is all about self-absorption. It's all about me. It's all about what I want, what I need, what I get need to satisfy myself. And generosity is the complete opposite of that. It's extending ourselves for the welfare of other people. Even, it's said in the commentaries, even to the extent that you might compromise your own needs. And that doesn't sit well with Westerners very well. But if you see what it's pointing to here is that the concern for the welfare of others is more important than your own. And you know that if you're a parent. You know, there's many ways that we know that in our relationships where there's times when that's very much the case. And I guess he's pointing to this state. Isn't that an unbelievable state of being? When we're so completely, in a way, self-effacing, or the concern is not self-word-facing. And I learned a lot about this through the years of working in the kitchen at the monastery and just different places around the monastery. You begin to see what he's talking about. And I'm sure you have too in your own ways. But, you know, when I would go there for many years, I'd be very preoccupied with fixing the meal. Usually I'm in the kitchen in the morning. I'm helping to fix the meal. And, you get this kind of giddy energy. I mean, a lot of it is lovely. We're all just happy to be there and we want to make it great. We want to make a fabulous meal that they'll enjoy and that will support them in their practice. But, you know, for many years, at least for me, I can say, it was, you just get caught up in the frenzy of it. and it's just about getting the job done. And, yes, it's happy and it's, but you, one is not turning around and looking at here. What's happening here? It's all about the gift. The preoccupation is all about the gift and even about the recipient. You know, whether or not they're going to like it, that kind of thing. And what the teachings are saying is that, you know, contrary to popular belief, that Donna is all about the donor. It's all about moi. It's all about what's happening here in that whole act of extending to others. Am I aware of it? Am I really taking it in and cultivating a quality of heart that does care and is attuned to the needs of other people? That's a very different take on it than we're often taught. One of the things that I used to do at the monastery to help me with that was just to be in the kitchen and, you know, before you get caught up in that, you know, get the meal done, it's got to be done by 10:30, you know, that and even what we're offering, but just to pause and invite everybody to light a candle and burn a piece of incense and reflect a little bit, even sing a little bit, chant one of the chants. And remember what we're doing. You know, we're providing food for these practitioners. We're giving of ourselves so that they can continue to practice. So that puts it back where the practice really is taking place, to where I can see what's going on in this heart. So I remember teaching about this one time in this year-long program that we have. And one of the gals who was in the program, she's always very eager to give me Donna, and she gets excited and giddy about it. And so right when she arrived, she was just getting out of the van with her suitcase and saw me and said, "Here," you know, and gave me a check. And I said, "Oh, that's lovely," you know, and I put it in my pocket and appreciated it and thanked her. And that week we happened to be talking about this. So then after this talk, after reflecting some on Donna in this way, she said, "I'm so sorry I did that. I didn't get to see it at all." And so I still had it in my pocket. So I gave it back to her. I said, "Just keep it until or unless, you know, you're ready to do it in a different way." Because, yes, I appreciate it. And yes, it's very valuable, but it's not about me. You know, it's not about my needs. It's about you. About what's going on in you, I told her. And she really relished this and went on to, become very aware of how, obsessed she can be about the gift. Not just with offering to teachers, but, you know, she had to buy a present for her daughter or something like that. And, she said she would just go on and on about what's the right gift? How much should I spend? How much is enough? How much is too much? Is she going to like it? What'll I do if she doesn't like it? Should I give her a return receipt so she can return it? All of this. And this opportunity to take it to a whole nother level just, changed it completely from this outward orientation to this, this heartfelt orientation. In one of Ajahn Lee's books, Frames of Reference, he said that this kind of attitude, this attachment to the outward orientation of Donna, it doesn't reach the essence of the true virtue of generosity. He said it really goes no further than simply clinging to beliefs, clinging to customs and conventions, and clutching onto these forms or these ideas of goodness. Can you feel that? I mean, I think this is just really powerful stuff if we take to heart what he's getting at here. So result is that it's what's going on in the heart that counts. And it made me, give new, meaning to this thing, this old pejorative statement. It's the thought that counts, you know, when somebody doesn't like what you give them, you know, oh, it was the thought that counts. But really, I think what the Buddha is saying is it is the thought that counts. It's you. It's your heart. Your giving, your sentiment, your heartfelt wish to offer that counts. And we can miss that. So don't miss it. There's some amazing, beautiful states arising in our hearts. And because we're obsessed with the outer, we miss the inner. Okay? So I think that's what he's saying here. Turn it around and look at when it's, when the generosity is there and the stinginess. The practicing with Donna is about seeing both. So when it comes to living by the precepts, there's a very similar thing that goes on. We can actually pick these up with just a hard core of self-righteousness. This is the way you should be. This is the way everybody should be, you know, and then the mind and heart start to become critical of people who, aren't, keeping the precepts in, appropriate ways. And, nothing is more annoying than the karma police, you know, whether it's the karma police of you looking at other people's behavior or doing that internally. It's very, very hard, very, very, very hurtful. And I think one of the ways that this attachment manifests is like getting too caught up in the details of the precepts. And some of these debates are important discussions to have, but they miss the point a little bit. Like the argument about whether or not you can have a glass of wine with dinner, or what about eating meat, or one I often hear is is it gossiping to talk about somebody like with a really good friend, and you're talking about, you're trying to get a handle on something that you don't like about somebody. You know, sometimes it's very helpful to talk about that, to bring it out. It takes such care with that around right speech. And so just asking, we get caught up in these kinds of details. And, you know, we can be critical of ourselves and critical of other people when we don't keep the precepts as we understand them. And I think it has to be said that if that's the way we're holding it, we have to know that this is very immature practice. This is just when you first come to it, maybe you can get away with that for a few weeks. But hopefully soon and quickly, one matures into a right understanding of the precepts and what it's all about. And admittedly, it's tricky because some of these discussions about fine-tuning what he's saying do have to take place. But really, you can focus on things too superficially. What the precepts and moral conduct, ethical conduct, are all about is about discovering for ourselves through our own observation, through the direct experience of aligning ourselves with skillful conduct and not aligning ourselves with it, discovering all about the law of karma, you know, that skillful actions feel good. They bring happy results. That unskillful actions feel terrible. There's something that's very off and very unaligned in the system when we aren't behaving well. And maybe we're being sensitized to that in other people. But we don't want to judge that or criticize that. But just to know that it's about waking up so that we can, in a way, internalize morality, internalize skillfulness. It's almost like I've been alluding to this a couple of times over the weekend, that we have to see, we have to be awake and alert to what it's like to be this way and what it's like to be that way. and do that in as clean a way as we can. And that means don't feel exalted when you're behaving well and don't feel diminished when you're behaving badly. Hold them both the same. But pay attention to what it feels like to do that, to behave that way. That's where it's all happening. It's not happening in the ideas. The shoulds. You should be this way. And the smacking ourselves around if we're not, and the forcing ourselves or demanding ourselves to be certain ways. It's not like that. The precepts are really pointers. They're kind of spotlighting the difficult spots. The places where we get into trouble. and with the intention or the purpose of seeing what it feels like. I have to know that for myself. You have to know that for yourself. That's the only way it gets in. It doesn't get in to the heart by bashing and thrashing or forcing compliance. You know, that's the one of the ways that we hold the precepts completely incorrectly, is to force compliance. And again, it's tricky because you do want to set up a resolve. You know, you're working with the idea of, the language of the precept is, I undertake the precept to refrain from doing certain things, right? So there's a resolution there. There's a resolve. And that is a player. And it's important. But you can't do that. That's like not even half of the picture. That's less than half of the picture. The whole of it, or the majority of it, is tuning in to the experience when it's happening. And my Dhamma buddy and I have a long-term Dhamma buddy for about 20 years now, and we talk our practice all the time. And one of our mantras through the years has been, and we often keep coming back to it, and she came up with it actually initially, because we were sort of trying to get a handle on that bit that keeps wanting to be another way, you know, and get so pissed off with ourselves when we're not that way, you know, or the bit that wants to stop being some way that we are and get really annoyed with ourselves when we can't stop, you know, can't stop doing it. And she said, well, let's just try this. Let's just work with it this way. Just to, stop being preoccupied with how you want to be and how you are not, and just pay attention to the way you are. Just pay attention to the way you are. And it's been a very powerful practice for us. You know, and the mind, you can feel the mind go, well, yeah, but I shouldn't, you know, but, you know, and no, this really is it. Pay attention to the way you are. And it all proceeds from that. This is what Sila is all about. That's what I was talking about the first night, refuge in Dhamma. This is the way it is. That's where the action is. It's tricky, isn't it? And I don't know about you, but it took me years to sort of begin to get that. It's not about being some other way. It's about being the way that we are and knowing what it's like in that experience. And the heart, the system corrects itself. It aligns itself when it gets that information. So we're trying to open our hearts to the way that we behave. And we, through that process, we discover for ourselves where we want to be, you know, and it's all can be done very non-verbally. It's all just at a very feeling, level. And just one more example of this that I love to tell. It was one of the first times I went, I think it was the first time I went to the monastery, but, I was trying to engage one of the novice monks in some unskillful speech. And, there was this guy there that nobody had liked. And so everybody was talking about him. And I tried to get the monk to talk with me about him. And, he just didn't pick it up. And, he just kind of stood there and went, like this. And then, so I tried again, and he didn't pick it up. And that moment was so powerful for me, because it was this moment of like, spitting in the wind. And, you know, I'm putting out this black gunk coming out of my mouth, and nobody's picking it up. And so it comes back on you. And I had this feeling standing there in the scullery at the monastery, of just this crud all over me, you know, this black slime just dripping all over me, you know. But it was a realization. I went, oh, that's what it's like. That's how you do it, you know? That's what it feels like to be caught in the speech. And that's what it feels like to come up against non-participation in that. And you learn how to be like the monk that way. It's very, very powerful for me. So working with the precepts in this way, as I said, the greatest work in this regard is discovering for ourselves what's called kusala and akusala, skillful and unskillful behavior, karma. And so that we can take to heart goodness. You know, it's said that when you really work with this over time, you don't really need the precepts anymore. You know, because the heart just won't go there. It gets it so deeply and so fully, it just won't go in those directions. So I'm going a little over, but I want to cover one more piece on this, okay? And sorry about that. I told you sometimes I can get a little long-winded. This last one is very important, apropos to our weekend here. It's attachment to rites, rituals as it relates to the meditation practice. And certainly, there's many levels of this. And at one level that I've seen in myself and other people is it's just an attachment to very external forms, to the traditions. It's like, you know, you can see these arguments and debates over who's got it right. You know, the Burmese, the Theravada, the Thais, the Tibetans, the Zen practitioners, you know. It's all Buddhism, but what's the best one? You know, that kind of thing. And I certainly used to do it myself a lot in the early years. But you come to see very quickly, hopefully, through doing it and paying attention, that that's all kind of proceeding from a lack of confidence in your own choices. You know, it's like I tried a bunch of different ones. And I found that I was most aligned with the Theravada, and particularly the Thai forest tradition. But that didn't make it right, you know. But the mind will do that. This is the right one. The others are the wrong one. And I got stuck in that for a while. And then you can get lost in these kinds of debates and discussions. But we're not saying that. We're just beginning to understand through this process, really, that it's right for me, and this is how my mind works. This is how I hear the Dhamma. This is the practice that I'm most aligned with. Other people's minds work differently, and they will probably find the right teacher in the right form, hopefully. But just to be aware of that as a possibility. But we can do the same thing with obsessing about choosing the right technique or the right teacher. And granted, you want to do a lot of technique jumping initially, just to try out different techniques and see how different teachers teach, but not to get so locked into it that you think that that is the practice. And this is sort of a phenomenon I've seen being in and around IMS for so many years. The style of teaching that comes out of IMS is very specifically a Burmese style of teaching. It's getting broader now, but for many years that's what it was. And there was a lot of territoriality about that. It was a lot of, well, worse than that. It was more this sense of this is the practice. And for many of us, that's how we came to it. So you think that's it. But, you know, slow walking, lifting, moving, placing, all of that, rise and fall, that's a style. That's a style of practice. It's not the practice. It's not even in the suttas anywhere. It's a way a particular monks have practiced and determined that it works and teach it. So we have to know that it's not necessarily in a particular technique. And it occurred to me one day that when I had this thought that, you know, Westerners, we have a propensity for getting locked into things like that. And somebody once said, the Buddha got enlightened under a tree. And it occurred to me that Westerners' response to that would be, what tree? we're kind of caught in this. Can you feel it? And we just need to know that about ourselves. It's a cultural, practice, cultural training. And it's fascinating because we're at one time, you know, demand a certain right to be an individual, and on another level, very compliant, very willing to give ourselves over to a technique. So you got to be careful of this kind of stuff. So, I mean, other things too, we can get obsessed with, doing a daily practice and going on retreats, both of which are very good and very important to do. But I'm sure you've seen for yourself in the formal practice, you can, be obsessed with doing it and get very good at following a technique. You can get really good at, coming back to the breath if you lose it, right? And for a long time, never see what took you away. You know, you can get very good at staying with the breath and never notice its arising and passing, characteristics. This kind of thing. It's not about the technique. That's what I think he's trying to break up here. It's about, what that technique is designed to help you see. If you can settle the mind enough, then you will be less glommed on to the phenomenon and more able to see the processes of the mind. But that takes some time. You know, I was talking to a guy a few weeks ago who said he's been practicing diligently for about 12 years, and he said he's just now becoming aware that he doesn't really think that he's been practicing at all. He thinks he's been sitting cross-legged with his eyes closed, thinking about things, you know? And I said, great. You know, it's fine. That's, I'm glad you see it. 12 years is good, you know? Can take you a lot longer than that to see it. So, you know, just to acknowledge that that's what we're doing. And we want to be honest about this. You know, I've certainly done it. I'm sure you do it if we're honest. You know, I can remember many years practicing at IMS. I spent a long time practicing there, and how I was completely operating out of a place of what a good meditator looks like. and you know, I'd catch myself doing it. I couldn't stop it sometimes, but just kind of walking around like that, you know, doing the slow walking and with my hands folded just right and my head down just right, and very confident that if anybody saw me, they would think that I was really good. You look the part, and I think that's what he's saying. Like, that's, be careful of the tendency to look the part. You know, and not really be meditating. I mean, we all do the best we can. So yeah, give it to ourselves at that level. But, we want to break this up. We want to be able to just be in our moment to moment experience. And this is the form that we use to help us to do that. I would even go so far to say, and I realize it's risky to say this, but I would even go so far as to say it's better if you stop your daily sitting practice than to sit like that and just pay attention to what's going on in your daily life and pay attention to what it's like when you don't sit. And, you know, you're still practicing. You're just not glommed onto the formal structure of it and calling that practice. And the rest of life is something else, you know. That's like, stop compartmentalizing the practice to these forms, these structures, and these techniques, and try to become awake and alive within them and within life. You know, I had a friend that, stopped sitting for 9 months, a very serious practitioner for many years, 15 years of practice, and then he just stopped cold. And over that period of time, he would notice, he was starting to notice that he didn't know what happened. I mean, there was some psychological stuff going on that I won't get into, but what he saw through that 9 months is through experiencing the pitfalls of not practice and the difficulties that come with not practicing, he began to see the benefits of practicing. And he started to sit again, but this time it was from a much deeper place. It wasn't even remotely out of the should. If you can feel that, he was like, wow, I really need to practice. I really need this. This is my mind is all over the place. I have no semblance of calm. You know, I need to do this. And it took the practice to a much deeper level. So I'm not suggesting that you drop your sitting practice, but if you have, or if you do, don't stop practicing. You know what I mean? It's a moment to moment daily life, observation. That's that 24/7 section of the Satipatthana Sutta. He's pointing to all of it. The formal sitting and the going on retreats is a form that we use to, up the ante a bit to make that better. So, as you can see, this is deep stuff, I think you could easily miss this. I know I did for many years. Just the subtlety of what he's saying here. He's not discouraging in any way, shape, or form us from doing the practices, but just trying to encourage, if you will, the cultivation of good habits within them and the correct understanding of what the practice is getting at. Not adopting, not just going through the motion, but actually taking it down to the heart and really making it a living practice. So he's inviting us to just notice the subtle states of mind that keep looking to external sources. They keep looking outside, you know, expecting that somehow if I just do this, everything will be all right, or if I just give this, that'll be good. Or if I just sit, that'll be good. It's not in that. Ajahn Mun said one time that the Dhamma won't serve you if all you do is, study and comply with rules and follow directions. It won't serve you at all. And he said, you have to probe into your experience to get free. You have to take it to heart. So just one final thought on this. I asked one of my main teachers about this one time, and I said, just tell me, like in 25 words or less, what's your take on what the Buddha's getting at with the Sila Bhatta Paramasa? What do you think? And he wrote this wonderful response for me, and he said that the human default is to go into automatic pilot. Because it's easier that way. So we get dependent on objects, we get dependent on structures, we get dependent on relationships, we get dependent on systems. And again, it's just because it's easier that way. And with systems, he said, we expect them to work for us with only a minimum amount of effort. And boy, could I relate to that. And with people, we rely on them to tell us what to do. And later, if we can resent them, if we do it and it doesn't work, it's them, it's not me, you know, they're the problem. And he says, we never really get to the point of using systems and structures and following the guidance of people so that we can come to the truth for ourselves. That's really what it's all about. So we'll sit, and if we don't see results immediately, we get frustrated. Who hasn't felt that? I saw a great ad one time, about last year, it's not that old, it may even still be out there, but it was this guy rather heavyset guy, walking on the treadmill, obviously, trying to get a little exercise in his life. But, you know, what's the commercial? 60 seconds, right? So he's on the treadmill for maybe 15 or 20 seconds, and then he gets off and he goes over onto the scale. To see if he lost any weight, right? That's this. Just rush it along, you know, if we don't see results immediately. And we can laugh at it, but it's dangerous stuff because it's often at that point that people leave and they're actually right on the edge of taking it to another level, but they'll leave because it's frustrating. You know, it's like, yeah, right. Now you really get, if it started to get frustrating, practice is going great. You have to know that. Just remember to stay with it and open to it. So I hope some of this is helpful to you and can bring some new perspective onto practice or strengthen your old perspective.